Then the summer was the worst on record. There was drought all over New England, corn parched in the fields. Ministers pleaded with God to send rain. Finally, in late August, a rain came at last, when nerves were at their last notch. In Boston, Thomas Prince, on August 24, gave thanks for the extraordinary reviving rains after the most distressing drought which has been known among us in the memory of any living. In Northampton, minister and people were so hostile that they even gave up trying to hold communion services. Though the chopping off of a relationship is always poignant, there is a special quality of tragedy in estrangement between pastor and parish. Edwards was clumsy at social calls, unable to ingratiate himself with facile small talk. But when one of his people met a deep experience, he was there, solidly and pastorally. In the dark hours of watch over a feverish child, when people really needed him, Edwards would be on hand. Trying to describe this, he had written, "When a minister and his people are united in love, no earthly connection, if we accept that of marriage and those subsisting between the nearest relations by blood, is so near and intimate." To a minister with such a view of his bonds with his congregation, feuding with his people was the ultimate sadness. One factor that sliced between Edwards and his parishioners was their irritation over his loftiness. The majesty of his mind had made the name of Northampton known across the ocean and in every college in the colonies, but it was hard to take in daily contact. The gap between his soaring expectations and the level on which most people live made him a mystery to his neighbors. He also grated on them with his campaign against taverns. Tension between church and tavern was not new. The first town meeting, which had instructed the town agent to endeavor to obtain a minister, had also debated a proper course about preventing an excess of liquors in coming to our town and of cider. In 1700, Medad Pomeroy had been licensed to keep a tavern near the pillory. That was a smart location, for it offered free entertainment when gabbing housewives or other picayune offenders were ignominiously displayed. Edwards did not realize that a tavern provided a club, a gathering place, where a man for the cost of a penny for a quart of beer could hear the news, participate in discussions or games of checkers, help himself to one of the long-stemmed clay pipes that were kept on a public rack. In the interest of sanitation, the smoker broke off an inch or two of stem before settling down to puff. In locked-in New England, a public common room was essential for village community. Taverns also offered entertainment to spice the uneventful New England winters. A learned pig, said to be worth $1,000, was exhibited in one Northampton tavern, astonishing audiences with its ability to distinguish colors, do card tricks, tell time. Dancing school was held there, and once the people did 92 jigs, 52 contra dances, 42 minuets, and 17 hornpipes in a single strenuous evening. When the Clark Tavern was built on Holly Street in 1746, it provided a necessary headquarters for the judges and lawyers who came for the general court sessions. A man of Edwards's tidy mind ought to have appreciated the symmetry in the fact that the public schools were supported by fines for drunkenness. He also used the services of the tavern as a center for mail distribution. But Edwards, whose recreation was to think in solitude, did not understand why most people enjoyed the taverns. Their owners, convivial, popular men, were powerful leaders in the community, and it was not strategic to oppose them in the way Edwards did. He antagonized another group who were to close in on him gleefully when he was in trouble. Though some clergy found him an inspiration and soul companion, Edwards annoyed the routine minister. Some resented Edwards because they sensed that he was more profound than they were, and that he made more of his vocation than they did. The mediocre workman always dislikes a man who works harder. He is threatened in this laziness by a man of driving dedication. Other clergymen were annoyed by the contrast between their trivial busyness and the emphasis Edwards gave to the same work. If he grated on the lazy minister, Edwards also pricked the pompous ones with such pronouncements as, "Pride is the worst viper that is in the heart, the most hidden, secret, and deceitful of all lusts." A minister who slickly manipulated people, with his own popularity as his aim, could not have welcomed Edwards' blast. The day of doom will be that moment when every person must announce his real motives. Edwards honestly worried about the way he snowed people by his intelligence. On the inside cover of his notes on natural science, he had written as a youth, "Let it not look as if I was much read, never to dispute for things that I cannot handsomely retreat from upon conviction of the contrary." He tried to be less awesome, but it was hard. So a group of enemies coalesced in the ministerial association. One who actively worked against him was Ashley, of the church in Deerfield. As a result, the church in Deerfield split, and the faction, who thought Ashley had been unjust to Edwards, founded a church in Greenfield. By the time the clash between Edwards and his parish had reached a point where it needed arbitration by the ministers' association, the clergy themselves were divided about him. In the town, gossips clacked. Despite the high toll of childbirth, there were many widows in New England villages. They were a self-assured group, grandly protected by laws, which gave widows unusual rights. Widows were the only women allowed a vote. They were allowed to carry on their husband's business without the apprenticeship required of most people going into the same trade. And they had lots of time to talk. Tea drinking was the great indoor sport of that time. After 1720, when tea was introduced in the colonies, the chief afternoon recreation was traipsing to the neighbors for tea. China was scarce, so each lady would carry her own tiny spoon, saucer, and handle-less cup, shaped like the ones used in China, where sea captains had discovered tea. The minister and his family provided topics for conversation over many a teacup. Another arena for the gossip was a quilting party. Women quilted in neighborhood groups, taking turns helping each household to produce one of these lovely pieces of equipment. They would sit facing inward at a square table, doing the easy stitches that required many fingers but little thought. So they were free to chat as they sewed, and at these sessions the Edwardses were thoroughly discussed. Sarah had been conspicuous because she never gossiped. Hopkins claimed that when she heard persons speaking ill of others, she would say what she thought she could in truth and justice in their excuse. So the gossips had to scratch for any scraps of indiscreet conversation to hold against her. Nevertheless, she was a target of resentment for one reason out of her control. It is inevitable for women to resent another woman who seems too good to be true. As Max Beerbohm suggests in his 1918 essay, Quia Imperfectum, most of us resent perfection. We find a man such as Goethe boring because he was unrelievedly efficient and productive. We prefer a character with flaws we recognize like our own, tardiness or a tendency to mislay keys or to be grumpy at breakfast. Naturally, other women looked for a chance to pounce on Sarah Edwards. She had never lost a baby. She had kept her looks when most women in that day sagged at 30. Other husbands chose to go alone to barn raisings or ordinations, but Edwards openly considered his wife a delight and wanted her to be with him. Their daughters were pretty, popular, and helpful in the house. Sarah Edwards was simply too fortunate, and other people could not help feeling jealous of her. It is easy to understand why people bristled at Edwards, who was so stiff and secretive, given to inexplicable thrusts such as the gift of the gold locket to Sarah. He bumbled badly in the famous incident of the bad book when he discovered that the young people in town were passing around a midwife's manual to chortle over behind the barn. It had been the month of March, 1744, and March is always a dreary time when things go wrong and judgment falters. Edwards always slumped in March, so this time he had stupidly read aloud in church the names of those who were to appear at the investigation, without distinguishing between witnesses and those supposedly culprits, and this detonated a colossal row. Later, even he realized that he had made a blunder. Among his papers are listed alternatives that he might have taken. On the back of a shopping list for a trip he made soon after to his parents' home in Windsor, Edwards wondered whether I ought to have done anything about it as the pastor of the church, whether I ought to have gone and talked privately with them. Hindsight could not help him. The damage had been done. Then he asked the town to pay the cost of bringing Mr. Edwards his daughter from Brookfield. Naturally, they turned that down. It was a silly request. He gratuitously made people bristle when he said he disapproved of the way they spent long winter evenings going from house to house, spending the hours in unprofitable conversation with no other object than to amuse themselves. It is wrong to spend so many long evenings chatting in one another's chimney corners. He also pointed out that when he visited in-houses, he noticed that his people had few books, commenting that, through their unwillingness to be at a little expense, they miss reading. Looking back at these mistakes, he confided to his friend Gillespie in Carnock, Scotland, "One thing contributed to bring things to such a pass at Northampton was my youth and want of more judgment. My confidence in myself was a great injury to me, but in other respects, my diffidence of myself injured me." He reminded himself to save his energies for big issues and not to tangle with trivial bickering. God does not call us to have our spirits ceaselessly engaged in opposition and stirred up in anger unless it be on some important occasions, he used to like to say. Two persons precipitated the final crises. The first was Seth Pomeroy, described as very high in liberty. There are some kinds of people who are chemically incompatible, who cannot help clashing. So it was with Edwards and Pomeroy. A duplicate of Pomeroy in a later day was Theodore Roosevelt. Pomeroy was a war lover, impulsive, hot-headed, a man's man. He was to roar off to serve in the Revolution when he was 69. To Pomeroy, a man like Edwards seemed pale and prissy, and Edwards' kind of work, long hours cooped up indoors, looked like lazy malingering. Their very glands collided. Finally, an uncontrollable quirk of circumstances was introduced into the picture. Joseph Hawley. This young man was from a substantial family in whom a streak of strangeness had shone before. His father, a cultivated squire who read Latin and Greek, had suddenly slashed his own throat on June 1, 1735, putting a cloud over the awakening. Hawley's mother wouldn't let her son marry until he was 30, and then resented it so much that she divided the house, retreated into her own side, and ignored her daughter-in-law. Though this genetic endowment was unpromising, the younger Hawley seemed to be a reliable citizen. He practiced law, taught school, and in 1747 he became first selectman. Yet he was sick, and his delusions centered most bitterly on the minister. Slithering through the town, scattering slander, Hawley was most responsible for the final wave of opinion that overwhelmed Edwards. The mind of the psychotic often fixes upon a person of prominence. This is the fact that haunts the Secret Service men charged with the safety of a president. Any celebrity is vulnerable. The towering man represents the qualities of the archetypical father. Any man who is a strong, authoritative figure risks the hatred of someone whom he may not even know. We will hear more of Hawley. The final explosion came over the question Edwards had told Sarah about on their horseback ride together, the matter of who was qualified to be a church member. Edwards, still hoping to meet the emotional antagonisms with rational reconciliation, asked permission to preach about his reasons for taking his stand on church membership. He asked to speak not as an act of authority or as putting the power of the whole counsel of God out of my hand, but for peace's sake. Irritably, the parish rejected this request. Next, he proposed that October 15, 1749, be a day of fasting and prayer, that God would have mercy on this church under its present dark and sorrowful circumstances, that he would forgive the sins of both minister and people. The people were too cross to allow even God to intervene. Edwards then tried to make his case through a book. He lashed a Boston printer to strike off copies promptly, and to avoid a wait for them to be delivered, the Edwards' great friend and next-door neighbor, Colonel Timothy Dwight, went to Boston to get the book. 20 copies were dispersed around the town, and again Edwards, who revered the printed word, overestimated its impact on other people. He also made a blunder, urging that none be allowed to cast a ballot who had not read it. This demand made many people furious. Leadenly, the year 1750 began. Church was a hollow ordeal for pastor and people. Edwards continued to work over his sermons until they were burnished brilliantly. Sarah, watching the stony faces in the pew, knew that few people were listening receptively. She also felt cold eyes surveying her thickened waist, for at this inconvenient time, or perhaps because of it, she was pregnant again. At a time when so much was hostile in the world outside, their relationship within the warm world of their marriage had extra meaning. They needed the comfort of each other as never before. But the pregnancy was a complication in such a strenuous year. At 8:30 a.m. on April 8, a Sunday, Sarah delivered a son, Pierpont. With the naming of this baby, the confusion about the spelling of the family name is confounded. Many primary sources, including Sarah's will, use this spelling, but other branches of the family continued the Pierpont form. It is not surprising that this was the scamp of the Edwards children. He was to have a distinguished career, but there was an unsavory streak in Pierpont. His will disclosed some illegitimate children, and his character showed an unevenness that may reflect the heavy strain his mother was under as she carried him. For the last time, a trundle bed was slid out from under the parents' bed and kept near enough so the new mother could be alert during the night for each sniffle, each whimper of demand from the baby to be fed. Depleted by pregnancy and emotionally lacerated, Sarah reached that point of fatigue where one breaks fingernails frequently and is inclined to weep at a trivial mishap such as a sticky door lock. So she caved in with a psychosomatic response to all the pressure and had rheumatic fever when the baby was 2 months old. The worst hours of the week were on Sunday. The door of the meeting house served as town bulletin board, where notices of new laws, sales, marriage bans, and town meetings were posted. As people saw Sarah and her children approach the church, they would fall silent and earnestly study the notices on the church doors. Then the hours of worship would be a mockery. Edwards refused to carry the controversy into the worship hours, for he believed human bickerings were out of place in that lofty context. He explained, "The state of the people has been obviously such that it would have been the occasion of tumult in that holy day." So he decided to use his Thursday night lectures as a forum. Working over his case with infinite pains, he went down to deliver it and found only a handful of people there. The following week, however, word had traveled beyond the town, and the curious had come from miles around to peer at the Northampton scandal. A few were as callous as if they were at a theater. Others were neighbors seriously concerned about the issues. Edwards noticed that his second lecture, February 22, was also attended thinly by my own people, but by a great number of strangers. The controversy shredded the town. Of the prominent Lyman family, four who are entitled to vote were hotly opposed to Edwards, and one stayed loyal to him. Edwards reported to his Scottish friend, Erskine, "There is a number whose hearts are broken at what has come to pass. It is thus with one of the principal men of the parish, viz., Colonel Dwight, and another of our principal men, viz., Dr. Mather, adheres very much to me. It is significant that Dr. Mather, who knew the family on the deepest level, was fearlessly their friend. He had presided at the births of the babies and stood close through the deaths of Jerusha and Brainerd. He knew them as no one else did. His loyalty never swerved. When Mather died in 1779, his tombstone inscription suited his stout spirit. Corruption, earth, and worms shall but refine this flesh, till my triumphant spirit comes to put it on afresh." Though the tension told on all the Edwards children, two of the daughters found courageous beaux just when they needed them most. The oldest daughter, Sarah, was courted by Elihu Parsons, a Yale graduate who came from a substantial family. His grandfather ran a profitable sawmill. His father had been a deacon at the time the new meeting house was built, and the family owned 54 acres of juicy meadowland land and had a handsome house. Though it was an unpromising spring for romance, and many must have hooted at him, Parsons was a strong, steady man of 31, and he was not intimidated. On June 11, 1750, he married young Sarah. Mary was chosen by the boy next door, the son of Colonel Dwight. Young Timothy Dwight was a genial giant, 6 foot 4 inches tall, weighing 250 pounds, with hazel eyes and a fresh, fair coloring that contrasted to the darkly flashing beauty of Mary. She was so tiny that her suitor would amuse friends by holding her on the palm of his hand at arm's length. Young Dwight had been the first white child born in Vermont, for his father commanded 40 men in a fort made of hewed yellow pine up in a risky outpost. There the older Dwight had distinguished himself as a soldier when he held the upper reaches of the river with 4 swivel-mounted guns, 1 cannon, and some Mohawks, who made a hobby of fighting river Indians. The Mohawks were rather trying allies. Dwight once complained to John Stoddard that the Indians daily call upon me for shirts, pipes, bullets and powder, flints, and many other things. Colonel Dwight returned to practice law in Northampton, as well as to become merchant, selectman, and judge of the Court of Common Pleas, in addition to overseeing the family's large land holdings. His son had graduated from Yale in 1744 and returned to help in his father's many enterprises. In their blue house next door to the Edwardses, the Dwights had wallpaper embossed with velvet figures and an elegant oak-paneled mantel. They were prosperous enough to have treated as a good joke on themselves a blunder they had made the first time they served tea. They did not know how to prepare it, so they steeped the whole precious quarter pound at once, making a bitter brew that had to be thrown out. The town liked to tell about the time young Timothy had played a trick on a notoriously absent-minded farmer who was walking through the village beside a pair of oxen, occasionally flicking his team with a long switch to guide them. Timothy crept up behind the cart and held it with his bare hands, stopping the puzzled oxen. The farmer dreamily plodded on until one spectator yelled at him, "Where are your oxen?" Another time, Timothy won a lottery and refused to claim the money because after he had acquired the tickets, the Massachusetts law concerning lotteries had changed. Once a bully from a nearby town swaggered up to challenge Dwight to a contest. He found Dwight hoeing corn. Leaning on the fence by the garden, the visitor drawled, "They say you are the strongest man in town. I have come here on purpose to try my hand with you." Dwight answered quietly, "I wouldn't want to hurt you," and went on hoeing. The man continued to twit him. Finally, Dwight reached over the fence, picked up the visitor, whirled him overhead, and nonchalantly deposited him back on the other side of the fence. Such a man follows his own heart, not popular opinion, so Dwight stoutly went on visiting Mary. She was an extraordinary girl. Her father had trained her in the classics, far beyond the level most girls of the time aspired to reach. She read voraciously and was highly informed in history and geography. An old lady who knew her well reminisced that her striking mental traits were her quick habits of observation and her thorough and keen analysis of men and things. Mary was blunt and impulsive. Another neighbor recalls a story told of how he cried all day when he was a tiny baby because he was being weaned. And Mary Dwight, shot out of her own house, marched into his home, picked him up, and demanded of his mother, "Mrs. Tappan, what in the world is the matter with this child?" Some accounts say Mary Dwight had 8 children, others say 13. Probably some stillborn babies account for the discrepancy. Among her descendants were 2 presidents of Yale and many other towering personalities of unusual physical handsomeness. So this was a romance with many consequences for society. But the engagements of the 2 daughters were the only glints of color in a gray year. In the period from 1744 to 1748, not one new member had applied to join the church. Many townspeople had stopped speaking to any of the Edwardses. What the boys went through at school can be imagined. Edwards had believed that the role of the minister was to be a prophet, but the people disliked being made uneasy. They were tired of hearing from him about the awful majesty of God. Edwards was simply too formidable a figure, and there was now no possibility for a reconciliation, though Sarah continued to try to bring one about. While she was forced to lie down during her recovery from rheumatic fever, she composed a long letter in her husband's defense. She wanted to demonstrate that his stand on the matter of church membership had not been a high-handed impulse, but the product of sincere, slowly developed conviction. She tried to recall everything she could about the sequence of events, and she toiled over her report, correcting grammar and recopying it until it was much more polished than most of her writing products were, but she might as well have written in Swahili. The political mood of the colonies that year added to the unhappy atmosphere. There was general irascibility because 1750 was a year of financial crises. There had been no stable hard money in the colonies since 1686, when the old pine tree shillings in use since the 1600s had been stopped. The states began irresponsibly issuing paper money whenever they needed cash. In April 1740, the House of Commons tried to end this financial anarchy. A long legal dispute followed between the colonies and the British government. Finally, in 1750, old letters of credit were called in to be exchanged for Spanish pieces of 8. Currency depreciated everywhere. Business slumped. The prisons were jammed with debtors. One traveler reported in June of that year that Boston was as dull and still as on Sunday. There was scarcely any money around except a few copper pennies. There could not have been a less promising time for settling a quarrel. 200 parish members signed a petition for Edwards's dismissal. This hurled the problem at the Hampshire Association of Churches. Now came a test of the strong feelings both for and against Edwards, which had been building up among his fellow clergymen. The whole community around Northampton was thrown into a great turmoil. Edwards recalled that the council was a most disagreeable and dreadful affair. Here Joseph Hawley enters our story. He was the man mentioned earlier, who, though outwardly a substantial citizen, was fundamentally unbalanced. At the council, the Reverend David Hall of the town of Sutton tried to rally Edwards's supporters, and he pleaded with the people of Northampton to remember the former affection and harmony that had long subsisted between them and their reverend pastor. Joseph Hawley, sitting among the rustling spectators, shouted, "Hall down." Then Holly seized the floor to read a diatribe against Edwards. 10 years later, in May of 1760, Holly wrote an astounding letter to David Hall. It showed that in all the years between, Holly had been haunted by the memory of the way he had acted that day. He also sent a copy of the letter to a Boston newspaper where it was printed. Referring to the way he had blocked Hall's effort to ask the people to act in charity, Holly wrote to Hall, "I heartily ask your forgiveness, and I think that we ought, instead of opposing an exhortation of that nature, to have received it with all thankfulness. I with shame remember that I acted in a peremptory, decisive, vehement, and very immodest manner. But, sir, the most critical part of my conduct at that time was my exhibiting at that council a set of arguments in writing, which contained some severe, uncharitable, and groundless and slanderous imputations on Mr. Edwards, expressed in bitter language. And although the original draft thereof was not done by me, yet I foolishly and sinfully consented to copy it, and as agent for the church to read it, which I could never have done if I had not had a wicked relish for perverse things. I now see that I was very much influenced by vast pride, self-sufficiency, ambition, and vanity. I had received many instances of his tenderness, goodness, and generosity. The church was guilty of a great sin for being willing to part with so faithful and godly a minister, because that was not generally known. I look upon myself obliged to take further steps, for while I kept silence, my bones waxed cold. Your real, though very unworthy friend and obedient servant, Joseph Hawley." Thus the true story of that June Sunday came out 10 years later, after Edwards had been hurt all he could be, and it was too late to spare pain to the family. At the time he wrote to David Hall, Hawley mentioned that he had sent a similar apology some years before in a letter to Edwards. Most men would have been tempted to rush into print with such a vindication. Edwards had not. Instead, he had written back quietly to Hawley, "I have had enough of this controversy and desire to have done with it. I have spent enough of the precious time of my life in it. I am, sir, your king's man and friend that sincerely wishes your truest and greatest welfare and happiness." But all this was to happen much later. On that actual dreadful day in 1750, Sarah and her husband had to sit in a meeting room where the very air crackled with hostility and listen while a livid Hawley spouted his vituperations. When the council finally voted, the decision was 8-7 against Edwards. Two who voted against him were Chester Williams of Hadley and Robert Breck, the young man involved in the long-ago hassle over his ordination. Hall found 7 men to sign this statement by the minority. "We cannot agree to the dismission of the Reverend Mr. Edwards. There is no just cause, because the church, or at least its committee, while they offer us reasons, will not suffer us to enter into the grounds of those reasons, which we esteem an imposition upon our consciences. We bear a free and cheerful testimony in favor of our dearly beloved brother. His praise is in most of our churches through the land." One minister was so timid that he did not dare to vote either way, Edwards reminisced later. 2 of the members of the council who dissented from the result yet did not sign the protestation, viz. Mr. Reynolds and his delegate, which I suppose was owing to Mr. Reynolds' extraordinarily cautious and timorous temper. So Reynolds, who was so solicitous about his own reputation, is now remembered because, on the one historic day of his uneventful life, he was scared to stand up and be counted. Hawley won that contest, but he spent the last 24 years of his life periodically sunk in melancholia. He continued to be a leading politician, and in 1766 was elected to the Stamp Act Congress, but he had periods of extreme depression. A contemporary reported that he smoked incessantly on such occasions, and his eye had a wild and piercing look. His friends would come to cheer him, but rarely succeeded. Hawley had no children and willed his land to the town when he died. Crushed and repudiated, Edwards managed to make his farewell sermon on July 2, 1750, a marvel of conciliatory dignity. He did not come to this level of charity without soul struggle. Notes left by Edwards shows that he had long pondered what he would say on his last Sunday, should he be dismissed. At first, he had blocked out a sermon based on a reproachful text, Jeremiah 25:3, but he did not use it. Sarah, sitting for the last time in the privileged seat where she had known both exultation and grief, knew how near the controlled voice was to quavering as it spoke these words. It was 23 years, the 15th of last February, since I have labored in the work of the ministry in the relation of a pastor to this church, having always labored under great infirmity of body, beside my insufficiency for so great a charge in other respects. Yet have I not spared my feeble strength, but have exerted it. You are my witnesses that what strength I have had, I have not neglected in idleness, nor laid out in prosecuting worldly schemes and managing temporal affairs for the advancement of my outward estate and aggrandizing myself and family, but have given myself to the work of ministry, laboring in it night and day. But now you have publicly rejected me, and my opportunities cease. While the stony faces stared back at him, Edwards continued, "Let us consider of that time when we must meet one another before the chief shepherd, when I must give an account of my stewardship, of the service I have done for, and the treatment I have had among the people he sent me to, and you must give an account of your own conduct towards me. Then it will appear whether I have been influenced from any regard to my own temporal interest or honor, or any desire to appear wiser than others." That was all he said in his own defense. Then he went on to tell of his hopes that the church could find a minister they could love and accept. "May you have a minister of greater knowledge of the Word of God, and of greater skill, that such of you as have held fast deceit under my preaching may have your eyes opened by his." Edwards then addressed special charges to five groups of people: those who are professors of godliness, those who are in a Christless, graceless condition, those who are under some awakenings, the young people, the children.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3000, 3730 by fax at 780-468-1096 or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.